Hello and welcome to another edition of the Magical World of G. Michael Vizzi podcast series. Thank you for watching. If you like this series of podcasts, would you do me a favour and subscribe to the channel, like and share, and help me get the message out about this podcast and the wonderful guests that we have on this show. Today, I'm having a repeat performance. Yes, I'm talking with Mr. Neil MacDonald yet again. Because the first time, we had a great conversation, but I did more of the talking than perhaps I should, and I felt like he didn't get a fair crack of the whip. So I asked him back, which was fortuitous, because he and Thomas Sheridan are just wrapping up their new book. And so we started out and finished off by talking about their new book, and meandered into all kinds of other topics about magic and megaliths and Cathars and Templars and goodness knows what else in the middle. I hope you enjoy, and thanks again for tuning in. What's this new book you're telling me about then with Thomas?
Well, it's about Reynolds Chateau, which I've been fascinated with for, cracky, I went there over 20 years ago, or maybe about 20 years ago, and it just fascinated me straight away. And so I did a book then, Mysteries of the Cathar Country, and it didn't really answer the questions, and none of the other books that have been out, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the Da Vinci Code, none of those answer the fundamental questions either. So Thomas came across with me to out at the Baton, to, you know, the area just around Reynolds Chateau. I went on a walk up there and saw the area, had a big long discussion for a few days, and came up with what we thought was the answer.
Well, so, I've read years ago the Holy Blood, Holy Grail book, and of course, like everybody else, I was intrigued by it. But then it kind of got panned, didn't it, by a bunch of people. And really, since then, I've never sort of looked at it. So perhaps what I might ask you to do is just sort of take us back and explain what the whole thing is about, if you would.
Okay. So the fundamental question is the priest, François Beringer Saunier. Now, he was born in the area, actually in a valley just across the valley from Reynolds Chateau. Now, Reynolds Chateau is a tiny little hamlet of around 100 people, and it's right on the top of a hill. Difficult to get to. You mean, if it wasn't for the fact that it's world famous, nobody would even give it a second look. Mm-hmm. You don't even see it. You see it as a quick flash by as you're driving down the road from Cox or south. You see it for a few seconds, then it's gone. But he went up there in 1885, got as his first posting as a priest. And he had a basic stipend, which is just French, you know, expenses paid, not much else, and the church was falling down. Now, he rebuilt the church and became massively wealthy.
Yeah.
He had the equivalent of multi-millions of pounds that he spent up there. And now that is the mystery. That's the base.
How do you get rich?
Where he got his money from, basically. And all the books that have been out since all haven't answered that question. They haven't even looked at that question. I mean, if I said, where did François Beringer, where did he get his money from? Jesus got married 2,000 years ago. Doesn't really answer it, does it?
No, and if I remember, it was all about the Priory of Sion or something, and that's all
pretty fun, isn't it? Yeah, the Priory of Sion is an organisation that they're a secret society, basically. I think I know the outer block of who they are. I mean, I know them, and they'll come out like many secret societies do, and they'll throw a fundamental question forwards that everybody will leap onto. It'll become part of the collective psychology of the collective mind, and then they'll debunk themselves and go back and disappear. Oh, we never existed. But what they've done the job, you know, they've got that idea. Mm-hmm. And that idea was, well, there was two basically. There was one that the Mary Magdalene idea, and the bloodline, the Holy Grail, the Holy Blood being the Holy Grail, which was the basic behind Lincoln, Bajant and Lee's book.
Mm-hmm.
But I always say that was a misdirection.
Yeah. Well, the Mary Magdalene angle always appeals to me, but the other stuff, not so much. And, you know, how does a village priest essentially make multi-millions of dollars at the beginning of the 19th century? It is a mystery. Have you unraveled it then, or?
We believe we've unraveled it, yes. I can't say now, obviously. The book's probably out in a couple of weeks. I mean, I'm working solidly on it now.
Yeah.
Thomas is doing the same. And I think by the end of Friday, in a couple of days, we should be able to send off for the, hopefully 2 or 3 days, we'll be able to send off for the proof book.
Right. So and who's publishing it and what's it going to be called?
I'll put it through Lulu.
Okay. And the name of the book?
It's going to be Boranger Seigneur, Priest Wizard of Redless Chateau.
Oh, now that does sound appealing.
It is, believe me, it is fantastic. I'm saying that myself, but I mean, it really is. It's different than than anybody's ever said. I mean, Thomas met me down for dinner one evening in the hotel, and he said, "You're not going to believe this." And what he told me, I said, "My God, we've got it." And it's.
Why do you think that particular aspect was not addressed by the other authors?
Because it was a misdirection. Don't look over there, look over here.
Right.
Everybody has always looked over there to the point where it's become massive.
Yeah, I mean, the bloodline thing never really sort of grabbed me as like, you know, so what? Like, I don't get that. The Mary Magdalene angle always appealed to me because obviously I've read the Gospel of Mary or whatever it is, the Magdalene book. And it does appeal that Jesus, the biblical Jesus, would have a relationship with a woman, and Mary Magdalene be it. So, I mean, that's appealing. And then that gets all mixed up with like myths of the British Isles too, doesn't it? Like the family came over to the UK for some reason.
Yeah, all that thing. I mean, we're not saying that Jesus didn't marry Mary Magdalene. He probably did, but it's not what we're looking at. You know, we're not looking at that now. I mean, the bloodline story goes into the Rex Deus bloodline from that comes down through the Temple of Solomon and all that sort of thing, through the Jesus line. And I firmly believe that that's the case, or they believe it's the case anyway. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm sure it does.
Yeah.
It just isn't. I mean, there's so many. And the Knights Templar were of that line, and the Sinclairs in Scotland, and so many of the big names that we know of.
Yeah.
I believe that's true. It started with Tim Wallace Murphy. Have you heard of Tim Wallace Murphy?
I've written
a few books on the subject. He was from down in the Cathar country as well, from the very same region. There's so much down there. You know, the Jewish Kabbalah came from the same area. Everything came out of that area. It's an amazing area. But Tim Wallace Murphy went to see Andrew Sinclair in Renlish, what's the little chapel in Edinburgh? Rosslyn Chapel.
Rosslyn Chapel, yeah.
And he went for dinner, and so he said he went for dinner, and they have menorahs. Now, these are big Catholic people, and they've got menorahs, and they say, so he said, well, it doesn't really seem right. He said, no, we're from a bloodline that is much, much older than all this. And it all came out, the Rex Deus bloodline.
Right.
So that goes to the whole of the British society and European society. So yeah, it exists. Yeah.
Well, of course, as soon as you start talking Templars, you've got a whole new set of mysteries, right?
Yeah. Well, the Templars as well, you know, they came out of the court of Champagne's court, and they went to Solomon's Temple to, you know, to uncover any mysteries that were left buried beneath, because it was their family line. Mm-hmm. But they were going to set up a homeland in the Cathar country. So that area that we're talking about, where Renly Chateau is and all that, that was going to be the Temple of Homeland. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the guys who ran Renly Chateau, actually ran Renly Chateau from the Hartpool Blanchport family, Bertrand de Bodsfort, was for about 13 years, the Grand Master of the Knights Temple. So it's like the Knights Temple are tied in.
Yeah.
With that area. The height of their riches, 30% of their, they owned was in the Languedoc.
The Templars are definitely something I got interested in as well, because unbelievably, there are actually quite a lot of Templar sites in this part of the world, which gave me something to go looking at and hunting for. And that's how I stumbled into the whole Earth Energies business, because I found this Templar church in, hang on, I'll say it correctly, Yindrikuv Hradets.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why I call it JH. It's easier. And it had this Templar artwork. And of course, you know, the Czech TV, the sort of sensational paranormal Czech TV programs are filled with these experts who look at the artwork and say that it holds the secret to where the Templars buried their long-lost treasure. And there's some myth that the Templars buried their long-lost treasure somewhere just outside of Brno at a place called Veveji Castle, which is a huge castle on Brno Lake. Winston Churchill was there three times and all kinds of stuff. It's got a big history. And there's a strange chapel just a short distance away from the castle, which is a Templar chapel as well. So there's something weird about the Templars in this part of the world. And when I went to the JH church, I had this different idea that the artwork actually held some knowledge about frequencies.
Right.
Managed to find two out of the four. I think there's four frequencies, and I managed to find two. The other two, the artwork is up way up in the arched windows, and I can't see it properly. I need to. If my Czech was better, I'd go and ask, can someone show me? Have you taken photographs? You know, but one of these days I will. Anyway, so the Templars are really fascinating in this part.
Yeah, wonderful. How do you check a frequency then? That's interesting.
If you go to this church, it's got all this weird artwork, and it's all very like flowing lines and floral patterns. And at first, it gave me the impression of Steiner's concept of living and dying, like cyclical nature.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, well, hang on, I'm following these energy channels, currents, and it looks like energy currents and vortices. Yeah. But there are, amongst all these sort of tiles, these painted tiles, there are some weird, absolutely weird images, like a naked guy wearing just a turban with a jewel here, laying on his back with his finger on his mouth like this.
Yeah. There's
another one of like some naked guy that literally is missing half of his body. Yeah, like, shh.
Yeah, being quiet. Keep the secret.
And these grotesque images, one of them is this peculiar guy holding his hand up, four, which is why I think there's four key points to be discovered. And the first one was this guy laying on his back like this, because he's pointing up. And the tile above him looks like all the others, but actually, when you start to look at it closely and compare that to cymatic sound patterns, you know, when you get sand on a piece of metal and you run it and it creates a pattern?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's the pattern that you would get with 852 hertz, is the solfeggio frequency that matches the crown chakra, which is why the guy's wearing just a turban with a jewel.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and the other one is a picture of this guy with big feet and he's got no belly. It's like chest onto hips, and he's tiptoeing. And the tile beneath him is another cymatic sound pattern, and it's for 417 hertz. And again, that solfeggio frequency matches that chakra that is missing. It's inferred by the missing bit of his body. So I started to think, well, hang on a minute. There seems to be four frequencies exposed here and related to chakras. And we're on this major earth energy vortex. So I got my phone and I played the sound frequency where the vortex is, and it was like static electricity. All my hair stood up on it.
Oh, wow.
And I've got a video of it actually on my channel. I shoot it over to you afterwards. You can have a look at these images. And
I think all this sound stuff, we don't really understand it, but I think it was very, very important, because when the Knights Templar, whatever they found under the temple, and they brought it back to France. Then they started building cathedrals like Amiens and Chartres and all these different cathedrals. They're supposed to be representing sound, because I actually heard a guy once who played Chartres Cathedral on the piano. It was amazing because he said, this is what it is. You know, wow, I don't really get that, but I think it's fantastic, you know.
Yeah, now there's definitely a link between the sacred architecture embedded in the cathedrals that the Templars built and sound frequencies. And there's definitely something there. I think people who've looked at the chapel in Scotland that you mentioned. I think there's some frequency type parallels been made there as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know for sure. I just kind of stumbled on this, and that's really what got me started with everything in the Czech Republic was this church with the Templar artwork. So every time there's a Templar connection, I prick up my ears a bit because, you know.
Templars. They're fascinating me for a long time. But if there is some sort of hidden technology, which we spoke of last time, then this is part of it, isn't it? It's like the basis of it, but we haven't really got how to use it or recognize it properly.
Yeah, it's like that story of that that guy in Florida, I think it is, the old recluse, and he built like a castle himself. And apparently two kids thought they saw him one day with an ice cream cone. And of course the cone is shaped like a vortex, and the theory is he was using sound to levitate the rocks, the stones.
He was sending something down to pinpoint.
Yeah, if you look at the Egyptian pyramids and all the old architecture, I mean, sometimes you get these images and they've got these like sort of horn-shaped devices. So it's almost, you know, you start to wonder, did they have a sound technology that we don't have anymore?
I'm almost sure they have,
I talked to Maria Wheatley on the last episode of this and you know, she thinks there's a whole lot to do with sound as well. So I definitely think it's worthy of research.
I think it definitely is. For somebody who understands that, you know, that sort of thing. I don't, but I really do think there is a lot in it. And I think if we could maybe discover that, that would be a really sort of really great foundation to build everything else on, really.
Absolutely. Excuse me.
The whole idea of being pinpointed as well, to pinpoint the energy. I mean, it's kind of, that's magic, isn't it? Where everything is pinpointing an idea, isn't it? You know, even in church ceremonies, it's getting a lot of people to think one thing intently at one point.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you put sound in it as well.
Yeah.
In fact, you probably remember I don't know if you did that in your training time, but I remember doing that exact thing. You would be, you would vibrate certain voice certain names at certain times to increase the power of what you're doing, and you had to get the level of the vibration correct.
Yeah, by the time I did my training, there was definitely the sort of vibrational work, but the tying into notes and frequencies was like more background. And I wish I still had my course notes, which I don't, because it did talk about the, you know, the frequency correlation. But it was like background information. So I definitely think that sound plays a real role. And I mean, you go to all of these sacred sites in the UK and elsewhere all of the time. And you're our friend who lives down the road, you know, from you, Stuart France. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been with him to one of these places, but occasionally he'll vocalize like a chant.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can feel the energy rising as he does it.
You can. Do you know, I remember years ago over in Malta, I was at a conference there, it was 2004, I think it was, and there was a guy with he had an instrument, and he would play this instrument up to certain levels and down until he hit the frequency of the temples in Malta. And as soon as he did, it was like the whole place was filled full of sound, and it's like, and then they could do the same with the voices. So there's something there, but I just wish I understood it. But he certainly, yeah, I could see them.
Talking again with Maria on the last one, she was talking about how some of these sites like Stonehenge, she thinks they were designed to kind of light up the landscape using white chalk and you know, basically in the moonlight, certain times of the year, day or night, whatever, they would light up. And if you imagine back then, there's no street lights or electric lights, so it's pitch black unless the stars are burning in the sky. So something like that would be visible. And and in the eyes of the people would have a true magical, it would have a true sense of magical power. If you then combine that with sound and chanting and musical instruments and really raise the energy, you start to get this real magic ritual concept going on, you know, sound and lights and everything.
With my idea of processional ways, and you can see a lot of processional ways would go in a certain and then they would turn, and then you would see. So you would have people building up the energy as they were. Then you would suddenly turn, you would go, wow, and you would see the sight for the first time. So that was, and if that sight, which would be something that they weren't used to seeing anyway, had lights there and some sort of energy frequencies and lights, and that would just blow your mind.
I mean, so you know, these people were probably technologically, in terms of modern technology, backwards, but in terms of their own technical abilities, far superior to anything we're doing.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, when you think of the way we've got our science and they have their science, and we've ended up building cities where you don't even touch nature. It's, to me, cities are a bit, I don't like big cities anymore. They're a bit, what can I say, they just don't feel right, you know. It's like you're so far away from nature and kept away from nature that it just can't be good for your soul, really, or your spirit. So they've done another thing. They had their own idea of technology, which is different to ours, but they still advanced in a different way.
Yeah.
So I don't particularly see what we've got as any better.
No, in fact, I'm not even sure it's even comparable. I mean, we build our cities really around the concept of the car.
Yeah, we do.
Think about it. Everything's about the car, whereas they built their landscapes with, you know, spiritual, magical, goodness knows what as the center of their being. So, you know, we've become such a materialistic, physically centered, convenience-oriented society. Lazy, in fact. And
yeah, everything's about buying things and
putting
them on shelves.
Society.
Well, I've just moved home, as you know, and when you look at the amount of rubbish that you throw away, things, well, I'll mend that. And 20 years, you think, well, 20 years down the line, you think, well, probably won't see it's been there 20 years. So, but the amount of stuff you just throw away, I didn't need any of that, you know.
It's also down to this sort of attitude. I was reading a post by Mark Stavish on Facebook yesterday, and he'd written a long, long post. I think it was he was refreshing the post, and he was talking about no one wants to do the work anymore. And he was talking about magical training. And you said to me, you know, about the sound frequencies and the intonation. And you said, was it the same when I did it? And I'm thinking, well, no, because by now, by the time I did it, the sound stuff, the intonation was still there, but the sound frequency was kind of just as an aside. And so progressively, even in the magical context, progressively, I think people are less inclined to want to spend hours and hours meditating and working and memorizing, and they just want to be able to do this and, you know, like Harry Potter magic or something, you know.
Well, that's the thing about all these drugs thing, isn't it? That's, you're going to a so-called shaman who wants your money and take some drugs, and all of a sudden you're spiritually advanced, you know. And a lot of that goes on, doesn't it? And you think, well, that's dangerous because your body hasn't been. Well, my body's not prepared for it now, but it was. Yeah. And the more you learn and the more you understand the background of it all, just throwing yourself into something like that is very dangerous.
Well, not only that, but I think if you have some, I want to be careful how I say this, but you have some psychological impairments or some mental issues or some kind of hangover that you're carrying with you, when you get involved in real magical work, that can suddenly burst out and explode in a very dangerous way. So you've got to be quite careful about the psychic side of it, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that is definitely true.
Yeah.
And it's like if it reaches a blockage of something like that, it can show in that if you have a personality a trait that isn't quite developed in the right way, say, then that trait will just go zoom. It can overtake your whole psyche.
And I don't know about you, but when I did my SOL magical training and I got through the 5 years, I think it took me six years of daily meditation and work. It was only within 6 months my entire life fell apart.
Yeah, it's supposed to, I think, isn't it? If you're not going in the right direction, then it's got to fall apart before you can go in the other direction, isn't it? It's that thing that I always refer to is Crowley. That is that's misinterpreted. So when he said, what was it? Do what thou wilt, be the hall of the law. Yeah. And that is like the basis to everything for me. You find out what your will is, which is your right path. And once you've found that, then you follow it, and then you go in the right direction. But if you're following another direction, it's got to collapse, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Before you can move across and find the right direction. So that's what was happening to you, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's quite, me as well, don't I mean, you know, it was quite it was quite fundamental. But these days I think I take a very sort of slow approach, maybe too slow at times, because I know that you can get yourself into some trouble. And I won't do, you know, you go on Facebook and you go to these pages and they're talking about summoning some demon. Yeah. And I'm like, are you nuts?
Would you do that? I mean, you've got to half not believe it to do it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Because you don't, are you going to summon a demon?
It's not that I don't want to summon the right demon to seek knowledge, but I want to make sure that when I do this, I'm grounded, I'm stable, I'm well prepared, and I know how to get out of it if something goes wrong.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, would you walk? That's another thing. Would you walk up to someone in a rough old area in a pub and ask them for knowledge?
Yeah,
you know, you're going to get yourself in trouble, aren't you?
Yeah.
Same thing. You know, you're going to know what you're doing. But the trouble is, I think there is a trend to do these things because it's become like popular and, you know, but it can be so damaging. It shows itself in illness, doesn't it? You can tell people haven't prepared themselves and haven't protected themselves. And when they're walking around.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's what you say, but you know what I mean?
In the modern world, I think it also goes hand in hand with, I had an instance yesterday where I commented, I was on some shaman and something page on Facebook, and I realized the post was just Trump derangement syndrome all the way down. And this is a shamanic page. I basically, you know, I popped in a comment, and of course, you know, everybody, all the work people. And I'm thinking to myself, and I said, look, my response was, look, if you're following a work mentality, then I don't know what it is you've learned studying magic, because work is anti-natural law.
Of course it is.
And the thing you learn when you study magic is it's all about natural law.
Yes.
So, you know, all you're doing is you're just pandering to a narrative and wrapping it up in a paranormal new age thing to look good. You're not actually doing any magic worthwhile.
Absolutely. Well, that's 100% true. Yeah, it's like going into something from the opposite direction and not realize. That's the whole thing about not doing any training.
Yeah.
You have to be so careful about what you're following. And just following, and if you're not only that, but if you're following a narrative that has been given to you by somebody without, then you're not even thinking for yourself.
No. And you haven't done the bit that says know thyself, because
absolutely.
Are you following a narrative if you know, because the first thing I understood anyway, I think was the first thing that shocked me was that everything I thought I knew had no basis in reality. Anyway, it's like, oh my God, everything that gives my life stability just disappeared.
Yeah. Get out, start again. Yeah. But it's better though, isn't it? I mean, I wouldn't go back to not having that knowledge.
No, I wouldn't. And in fact, you know, if there is reincarnation, I hope I don't have to start again next time around.
I think you start from where you left off.
Yeah.
I really do believe that.
I don't think I've gotten very far, but the few kilometres I may have under the hood.
You just want to do it again.
Bloody hard work.
I know what you mean, but no, I honestly do believe that you start from where you left off. It becomes a download period where it all comes back to you. It happened to me anyway. That's the only reason why I think it's true. Unless, of course, you decide not to do that. I don't know. It's too complicated. Isn't it?
No. I definitely would continue on. I am continuing on, and so are we all, I think. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's a case of asking more and more fundamental questions about. Well, that's what I found myself doing now, looking at a particular angle and thinking, is that really, really true? you know, and getting down to it, you know, I mean, like, what is God, you know, I mean,
yeah,
what is it really, you know?
Well, the one maybe I mentioned it last time, but the one I'm sort of struggling, not struggling with, but working on at the moment is, how do you get light from darkness?
Get light. Darkness, the opposite, isn't it?
Well, because, you know, let there be light, there was light, and light supposedly conquers darkness, and we have expressions like, you know, oh, I see the light. So in the darkness of confusion, you can see the light. And so
yeah.
It's like, so it's, to me, it's also tied in with the monomyth. You know, we take a journey into the darkness mm-hmm. of this unconscious in order to find something of value, light, but I would imagine, and return, you know, from the hero's journey. So
yeah,
that's what I'm think I'm working on at the moment, and I'm trying to use the Czech goddess of death and winter, Mirana, as the sort of gateway into that.
And then, of course, if you're in the dark and then you see the light, and then if you see too much light, it blinds you. You know, there's all this kind of getting back into the center again.
And it's the gray, struggle
of the gray.
Well, it's the struggle I have with truth. What is truth? This is where it started with me. I got into an argument with some Golden Dawn higher up on Facebook a few years ago, where he talked about absolute truth. And I'm, you know, being a neophyte, I just said, I don't think there is such a thing as absolute truth. There can't be, because I can't understand it, even if there is. Yeah. So for me, there's not absolute truth. There's only my perception of what truth could be.
Yeah.
And of course, he crucified me and called me an idiot. But this has been my little struggle for the last few years. What is truth? And if you think about what's going on around us right now, I think the question is really relevant.
I mean, all you can do is look at what you've learned and what you see, and just try and be as honest as you can.
Yeah.
And then say, well, at the moment, that's the only truth, but the truth I know, but I know it could be wrong. You can never really know the truth, can you?
No, it's not something that I think is really obtainable in an absolute form. It's only relative.
It is. It's
relative to who I am at this moment in time and what I think and how I see things. So it's, you know, truth is relative.
Of course it is. It can't be any different. I mean, that's okay, as long as you know that, isn't it? It's when you think, I know the truth, that's it.
Yeah.
All you can do is give your advice of what you know.
Well, the other problem, I think, with this concept of truth and relativity is sometimes I can be a bit fiery and I can be a bit opinionated or a bit pushy. And you get into a little bit of an argument. And after a while, I think to myself, well, you know what? From where that person's coming from, this might be their truth, their relative truth.
And it's not
You know, I'll leave it be. It's not worth it.
Yeah, because one thing you can't do is tell anybody anything.
Yeah, no, they have to experience it themselves, yeah.
I always think that's a moral, spiritual question to me, is if you see somebody going wrong, is it up to you to put them right? Well, I always think if it's somebody you care about, you tell them once, and then you leave it. Because I can get myself in trouble to say what I have done, where you try and argue a point.
Yeah.
And you know that this person is never going to understand it. Yeah. Well, not understand the wrong word. They're never going to grasp what you're saying, because they believe what they believe. And people don't just change their mind. And if they do, they won't tell you, because it's weakness.
Well, I think, you know, I've four kids, and my youngest and my oldest have both told me recently, much to my amazement, Dad, how come you're always right? And I said, look, I'm not always right, but I've lived my life. I'm 60 odd. I have experience, and I keep trying to point you in the right direction. And sometimes I just say to you, look, you're going to have to make your own mistakes, because that's the only way you're going to realize. But I'm going to try to give you some guidance.
Yeah,
what you're actually saying to me is that the guidance I gave you that you didn't listen to when you had the experience, I was right.
That's what you're doing. From your point of view, you're just guiding.
Yeah.
And then,
they still have to go and put their foot in the fire to find out if it burns.
Yeah. Your mum and dad are always, they know everything, don't they, until you're about 12, 14, and then they know nothing.
Exactly, for a while.
Got all that overnight.
Yeah, my daughter's 16. Sometimes she makes me feel stupid, but I know I'm not. And eventually she comes back and says, you know, okay, you were right. But she's actually quite persuasive at times. I'm like, oh, God, you know, I'm confused, you know.
Yeah, oh, God, somebody's in for a bad time, yeah.
So back to the book, because we've wandered off. I've done a lot of talking.
Oh, yeah. Talking about the book. Where were we up to? What were we saying?
Well, we really can't have you reveal too much about it. So what can you tell people that gets them interested in buying it without giving the game away?
I suppose that thing that we're going to concentrate on Boringer Saunier himself. We're not going to look at any misdirections with bloodlines or holy grails or anything like that. We're going to look at it, and it's a spiritual thing, I suppose, could say that. Or maybe not spiritual, maybe, what's the word? I can't say it. It'll be fascinating. It'll be, you'll go, oh, wow. I think yeah, that's what
it is. You went there, and per review, was it something... What gave you guys the idea? Was it something you found there, or you know, was it just something you were already thinking about and it got?
Yeah, I was already thinking about it. I went into when I first went to Ringle Chateau, and I went up to the church. A lot of people go in there and they say, "Oh, I hate, oh, what bad fear, didn't like that, oh, horrible." And other people think, "Wow, it's fascinating." When I went in, I just thought, "This is a Rosicrucian temple." You know, it's a church, you know, with a black and white checkered floor, and there's a Rosicrucian cross.
Yeah.
Thinking, yeah, there's more to it.
More going on here than
meets the eye, yeah. And things like, there's a big thing about the pentagrams, isn't there, in that area, a massive story about the pentagrams. And one of the statues, to me, is a pentagram. The one that's got Asmodeus at the bottom, then it's got a, so he's like the gonna say the devil, so he's the earth. On top of him is a water, you know, we go to church, you know, that water thing, can't remember it. So that's water. Then on top of him there's angels, so that's air, and there's some salamanders, so that's fire, and on top is a cross, a Rosicrucian cross. Now, so you've got all the four elements, and you've got the cross, which is spirit. So you've got, well, you know, the tetragrammaton, you know, the above, yeah. And then you've got the other, you've got the shin, which is spirit. Yeah. So you've got a pentagram. You've got the, because the four, the, you know, the tetragrammaton is the four elements.
Yeah.
And that's the bottom four points of the pentagram. And then the top one is spirit. Yeah. So that statue is a pentagram.
Right.
So that's, you know, so, and there are a lot of pentagrams in the area, so. That's another clue. Harry Lincoln was always talking about pentagrams, pentagram here, pentagram there, pentagram there. And I thought, well, I don't agree with this, because I don't think that the pentagram is not straight. It's not a pentagram. It's just five places.
Yeah.
So he was saying there's something about the pentagram. And that is a clue.
Okay. Have you ever been to the Hellfire Caves?
I haven't. No, I would love to. I really would.
I got taken there by Stuart and Sue Vincent a few years ago, and I can't remember all the names, but the Hellfire Caves, you go in, and oh my goodness, what a horrible atmosphere. It gave me a headache for quite some time. But above, the caves up above, the same guy, Dashwood, built a church.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get in the church, but you can see inside, and it's not a church. No way it's a church. It has like the black and white tiled floor, it's a particular shape. Same sort of thing.
Same thing, yeah, yeah. Well, I remember saying that when I said, no, this is not a church. This is not a church. It's a church on the outside, but underneath, there's some sort of magical temple there, you know?
Interesting.
And it definitely is. And I think that isn't by accident.
Do you have a cover yet?
Hmm?
Do you have a cover for the book?
Yes, yeah.
Send me the book cover.
I will.
If you will, and I'll pop it in. I'll cut this bit out, but I'll pop it in between us for a period of time.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got people's psyches. Yeah. Great stuff. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I think I shall probably have to buy that, although I must admit I'm still reading the last one you guys wrote. The trouble I have is I have like 50 books that I haven't read that I bought because, oh, I've got to have that. And they're in a big pile by my bed.
I'm the same. I don't really get around to it now. I'm too busy doing other things.
Exactly.
But this time of the year, it's tours. I'm starting the tour timetable, so that's all out. So it's a lot of effort, you know, to...
Are you going to do any tours down there?
Yeah, we're going in June to the Cathar country. There's two people on it already. I hope to take 7, so that's 5 more places. And hopefully when the book comes out, that should fill up. I mean, I've gone every year for the last couple of decades. I've spent a lot of time there, and I'm going down in March on my own to do some filming to back up the book.
Right.
So the tour is at the second half of June.
Nice. I'm trying to do that myself. If I could figure a way to ship my daughter off for a few days. I'll have to wait a couple of years, I think. But I have been to that part of the world once. I was about 14 or 15, and I remember having this weird feeling of I'd been here, like deja vu, you know?
Oh, I had that, yeah.
Yeah, so...
It was like going home. I go to the same... We stay in the same hotel every year. It's called L'Evêché. It's the old Bishop's Palace. And just down the road from Rennes Chateau is a place called Alert of the Water, and it's in the Alert Valley. And that's where the Kabbalah, really, I think, was... put together. I didn't realize this for years, you know. That's so weird, because I've been going there, staying in the old Bishop's Palace for so long, and then I found all this information about the Kabbalah, where it, you know, because there was a large Jewish community there, and it came out of that. And and that little town itself, Al-Aban, it's got its own mysteries. There's so much stuff around there. It's an old medieval walled town, and there's very few people live there. It's a holiday home, but there's only one cafe. Strange enough, cafe run by a friend of Thomas's, which is really amazing, really.
Yeah.
Because I went down speaking to them, and so they're Irish, and we got talking, and realised that. So I took him down to see them. But all the other towns around the area are busy, just busy, really busy towns. And this little one, he's dead. There's nothing there, and it's as if it's kind of the centre of something. It's been kept. There's no life in it. There's just nothing there. Nobody lives. Hardly anybody lives there. And that's a mystery. Why would that be the case? You know.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Absolutely. And when Sam and de Montfort raised, so we're getting towards the, when Sam and de Montfort raided all the towns of the area when he took in the Albigensian crusade against the Cathars, never touched our little band. Just went round it.
You know, what's really weird is when I was doing the SOL course and I was meditating every day and doing that particular set of visualizations, I started to tune into a past life. And I mean, I know everybody's going to think this is really, and maybe I shouldn't say it, but Simon Le Montfort was the past life, but not that one. Number 3.
Really?
Yeah. And I at the time, I remember, you know, doing the research, Simon Lamont, I know that name, and I start looking, and it was like, no, not that one, number 3, because there was several of them in the line, right?
Simon, yeah, they call themselves by the same name, don't they?
So, and then, you know, when I was 14, 15, I told you I went with my mum and dad on holiday down there, and I spent the whole time, I remember telling my dad, this place freaks me out, because I feel like I know it. I feel like I've lived here, or something, been here.
I do.
Yeah.
I go home. I go there. I feel like I've come home.
Yeah.
I'm just sitting in the hotel in the gardens there, and you know, knocking the local wine bar, thinking, yeah, I think this is where I belong. Yeah.
See, I'm not even sure I believe in reincarnation anymore, because that's again this what is truth. Because when you start thinking about, well, I talk to people like Anthony Peake on this podcast, and he does sort of post death research. And, you know, he's done a lot of work and come up with this idea that we actually relive the same life over and over and over again until we perfect it. And so last time I had him on, I said, well, what about reincarnation then? Because, you know, there's no room for it in there. He says, aha, I've modified my theory now that we have one life, live it over and over and over and over again until we perfect it, but then we move on to another one. So there is possibility for reincarnation. So I'm like, okay. Ah.
Well, the way I see reincarnation is that I believe obviously that we are just a little speck of some huge thing that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And of course time is here, isn't it? We everything is in has got a beginning and an end, doesn't it? Or an opposite. here. So we can only really understand that. We can't understand infinity. It blows your brain. So I just don't see why it makes any sense that when you die, you come back on this timeline to this place, just a little bit further on. It seems so limiting to me.
Yeah, so like a past life could be a life in the future, or
we could be parallel.
I think the problem I have with it is, if you have memories like I did, visual memories of being someone and hear the name and go do the research, and it's Simon de Montfort, you know, am I really tapping into something that was my past life, or am I just tapping into a residual memory on the Akashic plane?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I worry about. That a lot of people who think about reincarnation of Tutankhamun, they're just hooking into some memory that's out there, you know, some eternal store of knowledge.
Yeah, because it's like so many people with Mary Magdalene that, how can they all be? You know, it doesn't make any sense, does it? So,
but they could all be hooking into.
They could all be hooking into that thought form.
Yeah, exactly.
The ground, you know?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. We don't understand, do we? That's the thing. I mean, yeah. And I don't get it. I've thought about it a lot. But it's the Cathars, their idea was that this place that we live here was built by Rex Mundi, the god of the Old Testament, the bad god, and he locked us in this cycle of reincarnation. Yeah. We keep coming back, and the idea is to get to the point where you develop so much, you do the consolamentum, and that breaks the cycle of reincarnation, and then you can move on to something better. I mean, a lot of those, there were thousands of those people believed that. I mean, it's we don't know. That's the thing, isn't it? It's well, you see, like we talk about truth.
Yeah, it is.
It's the same thing. The best knowledge, with the best knowledge you have.
Yeah.
That understanding. But it just seems very, very limiting to me to say that you just come back in the same place or the same entity, just on a timeline a little bit further along it. It seems so narrowing.
And yet there are religions, and I think a Jewish sect as well, that basically would swear that that's what's going on, and that they can even find their past last family.
Look at Buddhism.
Yeah. So
they say the next Buddha was the last one, really.
So who knows?
Maybe it's true. Maybe we do go through a whole load of it and then we go somewhere else. So maybe Anthony Peak has a point.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, all we can do is chip away. And it sounds like you and Thomas have chipped away at that mystery.
I honestly think that it's going to be astounding and shocking to some
people. Sounds great. I love that kind of thing. I can't wait. So, again, when is the book due out, roughly?
Well, I'm hoping. I'm tapping away like anything at the moment, and sort of going into the template there. So I'm hoping the next few. I'm waiting for Thomas to send his chunk through as well. So The next couple of days, I should be able to send off for the proof book.
Cool.
So in a couple of weeks, hopefully, it'll be out.
Good. I shall buy it. I hope many others do.
I do too. Just a million of you. That'll do. Yeah. Of course,
thanks again.
Coming to it, that's all on the website as well. So
yeah, no, absolutely. I'll put all of that stuff up again in the description and encourage people to go and look at taking a tour. Mm. And thanks again for coming back a second time. I think you got a bit more of a shot this time.
No, it's been great. It's been great.
It's a great conversation. Thanks.
Interesting conversation. Yeah.